Welcome everyone to the Friends That Carry On podcast, where we dive deeper into our trips, unpack tips, and everything in between. Now sit back, relax, and get ready to go on a trip with your favourite group of friends.
Hello and welcome to the Friends That Carry On podcast. We are a group of friends who like to travel the world and create FOMO amongst our other friends who aren't with us, and hopefully inspire other people to get out and travel as well. And we live by the motto of life don't suck. Today in the Friends That Carry On studio, we got Tony Price, Brian Romine, and myself, Jim Scott. We got a special guest, and I'm going to let Brian do the introduction.
Thanks, Jim. Yeah, today we're excited to have Rick Gazarian back with us. It's been about a year, and Rick joined us and talked a little bit about his adventures. Rick's on a quest to travel to every country in the world, and I believe he's over 140 now, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Rick shares his experiences on the locations and places that he's been. He's a professional photographer, writer, author, podcaster, film producer, and blogger. And I don't know how he does all that, but maybe he'll give us some tips on that too. A travel leader and influencer, he founded and organizes a 3,000-person travel networking group in Bangkok, and is the chapter leader of Travel Massive in Bangkok, as well as the Asia coordinator. So, Rick, really glad to have you back again. Thanks so much for joining us about 7 p.m. Bangkok time, I believe.
Excellent. Yeah, thanks, guys. Excited to be back for a second conversation. So looking forward to being back.
Yeah, maybe we just start off with your most recent experiences with all of this craziness that's going on in the world. You had a bit of, I guess, an interaction with this COVID-19, and it upended your travels a little bit, or maybe a lot, I guess. So why don't you tell us about where you were and maybe just the last several weeks and where that took you, and you ended up back home.
Yeah, so I technically live in Bangkok, and after spending the holidays in Boston, I moved back to Bangkok for New Year's Eve, and I really had a first two quiet months of the year basically hanging around Bangkok, but this was because I was planning for several months of big travel. Early March, I took off for Berlin, and I was supposed to attend two different conferences. One was canceled before I left, and the second conference, Travel Massive, was canceled when I was on the flight heading to Berlin. So that was a bit frustrating.
Wow. And so you landed in Berlin, and did you spend any time there, or just turn around and head out?
Yep. So one of the conferences is ITB, which is like 100,000 plus people. So even though that conference was canceled, thousands of people were still there because they'd already booked flights, or, you know, they were already there. So there were a lot of informal networking events during that entire week. So I did spend my time there trying to build up some connections. But then on March 7th, the Saturday, I flew to Senegal to begin a one-month road trip in West Africa.
So
did you actually get to do that trip then?
Yep. So I met my driver and two friends, and from Saturday the 7th to March 15th, the following Sunday, we had an amazing week traveling throughout Senegal, because at that time, Senegal only had a couple of cases of corona. On the 15th Sunday, we crossed over to neighboring Gambia. Gambia. And we had a team dinner that evening. And we started reading the tea leaves, and things were just accelerating so quickly, even though we were really frustrated. And of course, we wanted to pursue the trip for the month. We all bought tickets that night to leave Gambia for the following morning, the 16th. So our trip definitely ended much more quickly than we wanted to. And on the 16th, I headed back from Gambia to Bangkok.
Mm. So You like to travel with these viruses going around. I think the last time we talked, didn't you get quarantined in China with the H1N1?
I did get quarantined, and that seems like a cute little inconvenience at that point, because that was just 5 days of being quarantined, and that was a long time ago. That was back in 2009 when I crossed the border from Nepal into Tibet, and yeah, I think it was H1N1, and I did get quarantined for 5 days.
Wow. Now, how about this time when you got back into Bangkok? Was there, at that point, were there any quarantines that you had to go through, or were you free to kind of move around?
Yeah, things are a moving target here in Thailand. Literally, there'll be a government announcement in the morning, and then it's retracted in the afternoon. When I did get back on the 17th, they had some thermal heat detectors set up, but beyond that, it was pretty straightforward. My understanding is literally today, the 25th, or tomorrow, the 26th, that no foreigners will be allowed to enter Thailand, period.
Wow. So here in the U.S., we're, of course, on the news, we're seeing every day they have a kind of a ticker going on the news channels of the number of cases in the U.S. and the number of cases worldwide. It's a bit scary. And do they have anything in Thailand? Do you know about the number of cases? Are they rising pretty rapidly?
Well, Thailand's been, and I'm obviously no expert in pandemics, but Thailand's been very curious or surprising to me, meaning Thailand got the second case of COVID outside of China. And it wasn't until literally yesterday that we hit 1,000 infections. So for, a month or 2 months, we only had one death in Thailand. So things are picking up literally the last week, though.
Wow. And riding in to hear on the radio, of course, it's all COVID-19 and everything. But somebody, I don't even know who it was talking about the response and why some countries have done better than others and others have gotten devastated. And they said a lot of them that went through the SARS thing, because that also originated in China, and it was more the Southeast Asian neighbors of China had been through this before and kind of knew that China wasn't always forthright on what was going on and had other protections in having gone through this before. I have no idea if that's what helped Thailand, but it maybe there's a case to be made there.
Mm. Yeah, a couple of different theories, and who knows? I really don't know why.
Yep. So what's your day like now, Rick? Are you self-quarantined, or are you getting out and about? Are you feeling comfortable with it?
No, I really have been self-quarantined. I mean, I did leave the house yesterday for about an hour of food shopping, but otherwise I really am inside my apartment here for the entire day. I break up my day with email and WhatsApp, a couple phone calls, a couple of FaceTimes. I try and do some work in regard to my travel blog or podcast. My new guilty pleasure is I'm playing a video game called PUBG. That takes a couple of hours, and then you add in some Netflix, and before you know it, it's time for bed.
So what is PUBG?
PUBG is just this giant multiplayer killing shooting game. I just started playing about 2 months ago when I went to my friend's house and he introduced it to me, and I refused to put it on my computer. I'm like, I know if I put this on my laptop, there goes my entire day. But when I got back from West Africa, that was one of the first things I did, is I realized I got a lot of hours of the day to fill up, and now I think it's okay for me to waste a couple hours on PUBG.
That's funny.
How about there in Bangkok, or most of the restaurants, what they might consider non-essential places, restaurants, shops, things of that sort, are they closed down at this point?
Yeah, and again, it's a moving target, but restaurants are all supposed to be shut down. It's only supposed to be essential services at this point. Some restaurants are able to do takeout. And hopefully that will remain. So to give them some revenue and to give people who are quarantined some different eating options as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where they're doing a lot of curbside takeout service here in our town, but that's really the only thing that's open.
I would imagine the street food vendors, that would be pretty high risk in light of the way this thing spreads.
Yeah. And again, I think everything's going into effect tomorrow, but there's like a giant wet market near my apartment. I mean, there's probably just thousands of vendors selling fresh fruit, vegetables, and meat just standing outside, obviously tightly packed. I wonder, you know, what type of situation that is in terms of spreading.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. Wow. Well, you know, we don't want to take up this entire interview with downers, but Jim has...
I do got one question. I don't know, have you looked back to Gambia to see, did you get out in the nick of time? Did the, you know, the wall come down and you got out on the last airplane, or have you looked back to see what the situation is there?
Yeah, so I'm in this group, West Africa Travel on Facebook. And yeah, I mean, my timing was pretty good. I probably had a couple more days of wiggle room, but Gambia and the country I was going to next, Guinea-Bissau, both did close their borders. And guys, you don't want to be stuck in Guinea-Bissau for 2 months. It's the fifth poorest country in the world, and it is, in essence, a failed narco state.
Oh, wow.
So not a great place to be.
Wow. So had you been traveling there, what types of places would you have been staying?
Well, it looks like, based upon the calendar of events, we would have got stuck in Guinea-Bissau. And we were actually staying at a pretty decent place, like on an island, but it was also kind of isolated. So you can play out all your dystopian zombie movies and think of, you know, the first 5 days, it probably would have been fun. But then you can imagine like 2 or 3 weeks in, it's like the hotel staff disappeared. You can't take the boat back to the mainland and you're stranded on some island. Could be a little scary.
Cell services go down, no internet.
Laughing a little bit because it's kind of funny, but it also could have been very true.
It really could be.
Wow.
Yeah, that was like 2 days from being real.
Yeah.
That's kind of wild.
Now, were you able to recoup any of your, whatever you'd paid advance for accommodations?
Yeah, well, luckily, literally, I had no accommodations booked, so I didn't lose any money there, and I didn't even have a plane flight out, so I didn't have to worry about that either. I lost a little bit of money probably on my driver guide, but he's kind of like a personal friend of mine, and he's probably in a difficult financial situation, so good to help him out.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, do you always travel that way where it's, and especially in some, I would imagine in some of those poor countries, maybe you do sort of got to, for lack of a better word, fly by the seat of your pants, but it doesn't sound like, even though I know you had a plan, that a lot of stuff wasn't booked ahead of time like a lot of travelers do.
Yeah. I'm really kind of, I don't fit one specific mold. Sometimes I'll be in a country like last year, I went to Uzbekistan for 2.5 weeks and I basically knew my agenda day by day. Here in West Africa, we were simply planning 1 or 2 or 3 nights out of where we would stay. So it was easy enough to make the bookings as we would go. And there's always a bit of a challenge. You don't know if you're going to have a problem at a border or the road's closed or the road that was supposed to take 4 hours takes 12 hours. So you want to remain flexible in that area.
Sure. Makes sense.
Yeah. So do you ever use travel insurance when you're out and about? I was wondering on this trip if that, it doesn't sound like you did, but do you ever get in the habit of doing that?
No, I'm 100% proponent of travel insurance. I always have it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, very good. Well, let's move on to some non-COVID-19 discussion here. So,
why it's such a feel-good story.
It is such a good. So the last time we spoke, like we'd mentioned earlier, was about a year ago, and I thought it would be good to start with an update on the number of countries you've been to now. Are you I think 140 plus?
Yeah, with those two countries I got to sneak in March, I'm at 142. I should have been at 146, but 142 currently.
Okay. And so over the last year or so, do you want to talk about some of the places you've been?
Sure. We all love talking about travel and love to share our travel experiences. So yeah, I had a great 2019 with a lot of awesome trips. Three great trips I took the last quarter of 2019 were Pakistan, Uzbekistan, and Afghanistan. All amazing.
Yeah, I was going to say, the last time we spoke, we specifically mentioned Afghanistan. You were talking about how difficult you thought that was going to be to make work out. How did you manage to squeeze that trip in?
Yeah, well, this was in essence a work trip. I built a relationship with a company called Untamed Borders, who specializes in countries like Somalia, Yemen, Syria, and Afghanistan. They're one of my sponsors of my podcast, Counting Countries. So we struck together a partnership that I would create a ton of content for them, and they would bring me to Afghanistan in their winter trip in November. So logistically, the reality is it's pretty simple, meaning they have everything planned out. They know the whole security situation. They arranged all the transportation, all of the hotels. So all I had to do is listen to my guide, sit back, and enjoy the country.
Nice.
So where are they based out of, Untamed Borders?
Well, Untamed Borders is headquartered in England, but one of their co-founders is a Pakistani who lives in Peshawar. And he's part of the ethnic group. He's a Pashtun. And Pashtuns are, I believe, the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan. So for him to drive to Afghanistan is like visiting your relatives in, you know, Western Pennsylvania.
Got it.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, I was curious about how Untamed Borders goes about, where they get their experience from in order to put trips together like that.
Well, their lead guide, Kozer, who's based in Peshawar, he cut his teeth during the U.S. Attack on Afghanistan, meaning he was a fixer for journalists. He would bring them into Afghanistan and help them get access. And at some point, there was a transition. And on top of the journalists and NGOs, they would start working with, we'll say, intrepid travelers who also wanted to visit the country. And at one point they realized, okay, we have a business opportunity here. The journalists are great, but there's an untapped market to bring travelers into Afghanistan. They had all the connections and the experience. And then about 12 years ago, they started bringing in travelers.
So were you in any hotspots in Afghanistan or on the Pakistani border?
Yeah, well, I flew into Afghanistan. The border is closed to foreigners. You cannot drive over from Pakistan into Afghanistan. I went to four different areas: Kabul, the capital, Bamiyan, which is relatively close to Kabul in the mountains. On the far west near Iran is Herat, and up north near the Uzbekistan border is Mazar Sharif.
So how did you travel between those cities?
Yeah, so great question. So for instance, Bamiyan is only a 3-hour drive from Kabul, but we had to take an airplane. So in fact, everywhere we went, we flew. So Untamed Borders, in their opinion, believes traveling by car is too risky and dangerous. And even that 3-hour drive, you're passing through Taliban country, and there's multiple checkpoints that you would have to be concerned about.
So what types of aircraft were you taking between those places?
I'm sure
well,
there's no
747. The good news is I am a platinum member of Cam Air. Cam Air is the big Afghani airline. I ended up flying 8 different segments with them over 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
One was a prop plane to Bamiyan, but otherwise they were like 737s flying around.
Wow. I wouldn't have expected that.
I didn't either, yeah.
But not the best of safety records either, though, so that's it's a little unsettling.
Right. No, obviously no fear of being shot down, or very little, I guess, compared to driving.
Yeah. I think the risk in flying is just their safety record. I don't believe any commercial flights have ever been shot down in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So, that place is all, or Afghanistan in general, is something I've always interested about, just because of the historical significance of that area of the world. I know it's been kind of devastated with all the wars. How was it traveling around, and were still some of the sites, you know, maintained, or was a lot of it still destroyed?
I mean, it's a mix of everything. I think my biggest takeaway, which I've said multiple times on my blog or talking to friends, is the areas I went to were fully functioning. So kind of in the back of my mind, I was really thinking like, you know, failed state and nonstop violence. But within hours of my arrival, I was at a kind of a nice restaurant, having a great lunch, being serenaded by a musician, and the tables next to me were local Afghanis on their cell phones, having fun, eating lunch. But in the same case, I mean, you know, the signs of destruction and violence are everywhere throughout the country that we went as well.
Interesting.
Wow. So how much time did you spend in Afghanistan?
I was there for 2 weeks, so a pretty good amount of time.
Yeah. Any favorite stories or really unique experiences?
A lot. So I'll just give a couple
highlights.
One I thought was pretty interesting is in the west of Afghanistan, in that town called Herat, is we went to a really interesting museum called the Jihad Museum. So
wow.
Jihad are the holy fighters protecting Islam from invaders. So this was a really well-maintained, beautifully, recently built museum in this town, and it was documenting, in essence, the war against the Soviet Union. And they had, you know, Soviet planes and artillery and just thousands of pictures of all of the jihadists who perished in the war. So, I mean, definitely a learning experience, as well as kind of moving to see the sacrifices that the Afghan people made during this time period. And our tour guide was also a former Mujahideen as well.
Interesting.
That is. I can honestly say you're the first person I know that have gotten to visit that.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Well, you can imagine there's not a lot of foreigners at that, right. At that museum.
So when you say recently built, any idea of when that was completed, that museum, or is it still ongoing?
No, it's definitely completed. I mean, let's say several years ago. I mean, it's in very good shape. It's definitely new.
Any mention or anything to Charlie Wilson, who had was the congressman that sent a bunch of aid to the jihadists during that time?
Excellent question. They did have one room with a lot of photographs of foreign supporters. I can't remember if Charlie Wilson's photo was up there, but probably deserves to be.
Right.
That's pretty amazing, though.
Yeah. So any kind of anti-American? I know we're probably not their favorite country, maybe during that time period, but
depends if you're Taliban or not.
More recently, right. I didn't was just curious what the feel was there towards Americans.
Yeah, great question. So, I mean, for those who've been to Iran, when you walk on the streets, you'll be confronted everywhere with anti-American propaganda. I mean, it's ubiquitous. In Afghanistan, there is no outwardly appearance of anti-Americanism. And in general, all the people I spoke to were either at worst indifferent or on the other end, really nice, gracious, hospitable. And many times I would tell them I was American and there was no negative implications of sharing that with them.
That's good to know.
Yeah, that's real good.
Yeah. So how many were in your group as you were traveling through Afghanistan?
Yeah, so the way it works is there were seven travelers and two guides, and we would typically drive around in three very local cars to blend in, and we would also dress as locals.
Okay.
That's pretty cool. So
did they provide that?
I was going to say, did you bring that back too? And are you, do you walk around in Bangkok wearing that? That'd be kind of cool.
Well, ironically enough, I did own my my outfit beforehand because when I was in Pakistan, when I went to visit Peshawar, I did dress as a local there. And those are the same clothing that you would wear in Afghanistan. Nice. But I have not worn them in Bangkok yet. I'll have to save it for a special occasion.
Yeah. Now, did Pakistan have any anti-American areas or in general, or is it kind of open like Afghanistan?
Yeah, I would say it's definitely, you know, not similar to Iran. There's no outward anti-American propaganda that I saw. The propaganda that I did see was anti-Indian, pro-Kashmir independence information and propaganda, because the time of my visit was somewhat shortly after India kind of took greater control of Kashmir, and this incensed the Pakistani nation and people. So I did see a lot of that while traveling around.
And if I remember right, and my memory is not good, you had, on the last time we spoke, you said Pakistan was one of the harder places to get into, or you hadn't gotten to it because of, and I forget exactly why, but there was some difficulty there. And I might be wrong on that, but did you incur any of those difficulties, or was it set up by Peshawar and that made it a lot easier?
I guess when I said that, that was 100% accurate. But since then, the Pakistani government has done a complete 180 on getting visas to tourists. So back when we spoke, it was in general challenging for foreigners to get Pakistani tourist visas to visit. But since then, they switched to an e-visa, and it's 100% better. And that's actually why I ended up visiting Pakistan. When I read the news about their transition to e-visa, I started immediately to start planning my trip there.
That's cool. Wow. So did you do all of the work to get your visas, or was that something that was included through Untamed Borders that they helped you with?
So for Pakistan, I did the visa myself 100% on the Pakistani government online portal. For the Afghan visa, I did have to send my passport down to the Afghanistan embassy in Washington, D.C. I did that independently, but I also had a letter of invitation issued by Untamed Borders.
Interesting. Gotcha. So how long did that take to go through the
get the invitation?
Yeah, well, the invitation, but the just getting the visa itself. I mean, was it a longer process or fairly normal time frame?
Well, I'll comment on both. So Pakistan, it was a pretty straightforward process. The one thing which was a little time consuming for me is you had to write every country you'd been to in the last 10 years with the dates. So that was a bit of a pain in the butt. While it was a simple process, it did take them about 6 weeks to send me my e-visa letter. But all things being equal, I mean, to me, this was like a layup. It was great. For the Afghanistan visa, I mean, I was kind of surprised. They have an online portal as well that was really efficient. So I filled out all my information. I paid online. Then you would print the application and send down your passport to the embassy. I was supposed to get it back in about 2 weeks. And after 2 weeks, I realized I never heard back. So I logged on to the portal. And this is like, you know, when you get a knot in your stomach. So I log on to the portal and it goes, never received passport and documents.
Geez.
And I'm like, ugh. I had sent them my second passport and I'd already left the country. I was in Japan. So then I'm frantically trying to reach the Afghan embassy from Japan. I get a hold of somebody on a Friday. They're like, oh, that guy, Mahmoud, he's not here today. You have to call back next week. So that did not make me feel any better. But miraculously, that night, my dad, who lives in Boston, he received my passport back from Afghanistan embassy with my visa. So they're very good at processing them, but they don't bother updating the website.
Yeah, that's got to be a bad feeling.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Very yucky.
How about for Uzbekistan? What was the process like there?
Yeah, it's another travel miracle, I guess. I don't know the name of the leader. They had the same president since their independence in 1991. He died about 2 years ago. The new president, Uzbekistan, again, this guy is making an 180-degree turn in terms of working within the tourism sector. So again, Uzbekistan was this real pain in the butt, difficult country to get a visa. It's now e-visa, and it's really simple. In addition, I mean, the country previously didn't have ATMs. They were really difficult on customs, meaning they would literally go through your laptop looking for contraband. You would have to get a special receipt from every hotel you stayed at and present it at the airport when you're exiting. There's a couple of other rules as well, and they basically got rid of all of them.
Oh, wow.
I can see why you wouldn't want to go before.
So what was it? What was the travels like in Uzbekistan? Were you there for a couple of weeks as well?
Yeah, that was another 2-week trip. And I'm telling you, I mean, I love Central Asia, the stands to begin with. I've been to all of them except for Turkmenistan at this point. I think Uzbekistan is a great introduction to the region. There's good infrastructure. There's a good tourism industry there. There is so much to see, and it's also an incredible cost point. So highly encourage people to go there. It's amazing. 2 weeks is a great amount. 4 weeks would have been better.
Oh, wow.
So what were some of the highlights there? I mean, what are the great things to see in Uzbekistan?
Yeah, so I'll try and do my itinerary quickly. I arrived in the capital, Tashkent, and the very next morning I flew to the far west, which is a small city called Nukus. Nukus is famous for their art museum. It's considered one of the best art museums in the world. I'm not a big art museum guy, but definitely was interesting in checking the box for me. But for other people, it's an actual destination city to go visit this museum. Then after that, I went to the Aral Sea. And this is a full day's drive, half roads, half non-existent roads.
Oh, wow.
Aral Sea used to be the fourth largest lake in the world. It's now shrunk by 90%. So it's one of the biggest ecological disasters in the world. But I went up with this company called IM Tours, A-Y-I-M. They picked me up in Nukus. They took me up to the lake with a lot of awesome stops. I slept over by the lake. And then we drove back the next day with a couple more stops. After that, I went to visit three amazing, awesome cities on the Silk Road, Khiva, Bukhara, and Samarkand. So these are the stereotypical images of beautiful blue mosques and shrines that you would imagine seeing on the Silk Road. And all three were awesome in their own way.
That sounds amazing.
We went to Cambodia this January, and our friends, this is the first time for Tony and I, but our friends have been there in 2012, and I don't know, and I'm trying to see if it compares to Uzbekistan, where they just sort of opened up maybe 7, 8, 10 years ago to tourists, and it's grown by leaps and bounds from maybe a million a year to now where it's 8 or 9 million going to the temples and so forth. Is Uzbekistan sort of similar to that since they've changed and are the new leaders letting people in? Are you starting to see more tourists, and do you think it's going to grow very rapidly, or do they already have a decent amount of tourists going?
Well, I don't have the benchmark from the old president, and I can safely assume tourism has grown since the new president came in power. But, you know, relative to an Inger Watt, it's still untouched, very untouched at this point.
Wow. Interesting. Might be a place I need to put on the on our to-do list.
100%.
Yeah, it sounds like it. We haven't done really any of that Central Asia at all. I mean, we've hit the Eastern Europe and, you know, Southeast Asia, but not Central Asia.
Well, on a side note, you guys were where for New Year's Eve?
Yeah, we have to apologize, Rick. We kind of forgot to reach out to you because we were in Bangkok for New Year's Eve this year.
Oh, this year?
Yeah. Yeah. It was one of those that it was kind of like after the thought, because we were supposed to meet up with some friends that we'd met in Pamplona, and then that turned into a craziness because he ended up having an emergency appendectomy.
Yeah, well, on the flight.
Yeah, on a flight.
Appendix rupture.
After he had just done Everest base camp,
yeah,
right?
He just got off Everest. Man. But, yeah, so we were thinking about it after. I was like, uh-oh. We didn't even reach out to Rick at all. Well, but yeah,
I won't give you guilt trip this time.
That's okay. We'll be back, so we'll make sure we catch up next time if you're in country. But yeah, we were in Bangkok for New Year's Eve and hung out for about 3 or 4 days before we headed to Cambodia. So
yeah. Well, I hope you guys had a great time, and I'm sorry I missed you.
Yeah, we did, and you know, Jim, and it was our first trip to Bangkok, and I have to admit, I could spend a month there just eating food. Because I probably ate 7 meals a day.
you wanted to try everything,
right? Oh, I tried
everything.
We'd sit down at a table and for a drink, and they'd put down a menu, and the guys would be like, no, I'm not full. I was like, no, I'll take the menu. I'm good. I was going to ask you, Rick, where do you actually live in Bangkok? What area?
Yeah, I live in the Sukhumvit area next to BTS Nana. Okay. If you know that one.
Know roughly where that is. We stayed down near, what's it called? Khaesan Road area.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. That's, well, depending on traffic, that's either 20 minutes or 60 minutes away from my apartment.
Yeah. But it was kind of, I mean, it was a good area to kind of hang out and get our feet wet and walk around. So it was good, good times.
Yeah. Awesome.
So, Rick, how are you planning for your future trips now? I mean, you know, obviously none of us know when all of this craziness will stop. So have you stopped planning, or are you continuing to plan and kind of going at it with an optimistic approach?
That's a tough question for all of us. You know, all of my trips on paper, on my little Excel spreadsheet, had been planned out for 2020 all the way into October. Mm-hmm. The reality is there's no point into researching further on any of those trips until we have more clarity in regard to what the situation is. So those trips will sit on my Excel spreadsheet. Whether I get to do any of them this year, I mean, that's a dream. I would love to, but have to stand still and wait to see what happens.
So what are some of those trips that are at least on the drawing board?
Well, as you guys know, I was supposed to be in West Africa for a month. Then I was going to go to Armenia for about 3 weeks, then back to Bangkok for about 10 days. Then I was going to go to Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, Marshall Islands, and Kiribati in the Pacific. That would get me to mid-June, where I would have gone to the U.S. for a couple of months. And then August would have been Malawi, Comoros, Madagascar, Mauritius, Mauritania, Eswatini, Lesotho, and Botswana, which would have taken me to October.
And are any of those places new countries or virgin countries to you?
Yep. All those countries except for Armenia are new to me. We're going to be new to me.
So you would have knocked out a lot.
Yeah, my goal was to get to 160 countries this year.
Okay. Now, if I recall, Armenia, that's your homeland, your ethnic homeland. Is that right?
Exactly. So I make an annual visit there, as I've done since 2002.
Yeah, it's still on my list.
So if everything were to kind of clear up globally at once and things opened up, would your first trip be to go back to where you left off, to Gambia?
Yeah, I would probably push that trip back to the end of the year or early next year. You don't want to be driving in West Africa really in summer or the rainy season where the roads can be unpassable. So I would probably, soon, if by some miracle things are better in mid-May, I would start off with Papua New Guinea and then do that Pacific trip and then get to the U.S. for summer.
Are you going to, when you come to the U.S., you're going back to Chicago or?
When I go to the U.S., I kind of split up my time. Boston, where my dad lives, and Chicago, where I still have a condo there.
Okay. Nice. Yeah, we're kind of in a holding pattern too. We were supposed to be going to, we're still saying we're going. We're going to Munich for Oktoberfest again, and then hitting a few places. So we'll see what happens. So we've already had to cancel a few trips as well. So
now, so how far in advance do you all have to cancel, say, hotels, flights for the Munich trip? Yeah, for you guys.
I mean, the only thing that we have, our hotel. Just because you have to book that so far in advance to get something close. And I think we have up till
60 days or 90 days. 60 days prior.
I think we're okay.
So we're good till like August to cancel
and
not cost us anything. Yeah. And then we haven't booked the flight.
Yeah, we were just kind of waiting.
We were looking at it. We probably would have here recently. But
I might still if they give me the waiver.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you too, have you done any more work with was it the G Travel? Because I know you're still listed as a wanderer, right?
Yeah, they're G Adventures out of Toronto, one of the biggest tour providers in the world. They operate in 100 different countries. And I did go on an awesome trip with them last year to Uganda and Rwanda, which was February of last year, but feels like 10 years ago after everything that's happened. And this was total bucket list. Because I trekked with gorillas in Uganda, and it was pretty fantastic.
Yeah, I remember you telling us about that last time. I guess you just had done that, so I was curious if you'd done anything else. So, the other reason I mentioned it is one of the other people who are listed as a wanderer is Gary Arndt that Jim and I got to meet a few months. Well, I guess it's been 6 months ago,
back in September.
September, yeah.
Yeah, I think I listened. I think you met him at T-Bex and interviewed him. I listened to that interview.
Oh, did you? Okay. Yeah, so it was kind of fun.
Yep, I know Gary is a good guy.
Yeah, he's funny.
Well, I did want to ask Rick today about Travel Massive a little bit. Would you be willing to, as the kind of the leader there in the Thailand area, can you talk to us a little bit about Travel Massive?
Of course. Travel Massive is the largest online network of travel professionals in the world. In addition, they have a real-life component as well. There's 160 chapters around the globe. So you have all of the online networking stuff that you have like you would on LinkedIn, but then the chapters around the globe, whether it's in New York City or Bangkok, there's local events that travel professionals can attend as well. And Travel Professional is a podcaster, a blogger, someone who works at a hotel, an airline, someone who works at an OTA or tour operator. So anybody who's deriving some work from the travel industry.
Gotcha.
And typically at those events, do you have speakers and workshops, or is it just a networking event, or maybe a bit of all that?
It's definitely a bit of all that. One of the reasons is it's kind of an organic situation, meaning the chapter leader in whatever city they're in figures out what works. So some of them might be, networking, happy hours. Some of them might be a panel that's moderated. Others will be speakers, or it might be an event like taking a tour or visiting a hotel.
Nice. Now, since you're in charge of Bangkok, what do you typically do? Is this something you have like an annual event there, or?
No, it's definitely more than that. Okay. My little strategy in Bangkok is I mix it up or I alternate. Near my house is a Hyatt hotel, a new Hyatt with a, you know, I mean, there's so many awesome roof decks in Bangkok, but they have a awesome roof deck here. And I organized a happy hour networking event on the rooftop there with two other local travel groups. So one is called Mekong Tourism Authority, and the other one is called PATA, which is a giant trade association for the travel industry. So we all try host the happy hour, and then I alternate with either a event with a speaker or a panel providing value-added information.
Gotcha. How often do you do those?
I would say we do about 6 to 8 events a year.
Okay. Whenever you're actually in country, right?
Exactly. That is part of the catch. I have to be here enough to set it up.
Do you have others that work with you on that, or are you just kind of the sole person that sets everything up?
Nope. In Bangkok, there's 3 chapter leaders. I'm one of the 3, so they also pitch in.
Gotcha. Okay. I wonder what's closest to us? Anything here in the U.S., like D.C. or Baltimore?
There's several around.
Several.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got to assume. I'm pretty sure there's one in D.C.
Yeah, I think there's a D.C., and I know for sure there's a New York. So.
Yeah.
Definitely New York, Philly. So you get some options there to take a look and join. I know your podcast made the list. Travel Massive just came out a list of the 29 podcasters to listen to, and Friends That Carry On was on that list.
Yeah,
we appreciate that.
Yeah, we absolutely appreciate that. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, very exciting for us.
Well, speaking of podcasts, I just listened to your, episode that just came out Lorenzo?
Lorenzo, yes.
Yeah. So that, I guess he has been to all the countries now, correct?
Yeah. So, I mean, there were probably a half a dozen guys that literally just finished, the first month or 2 months of this year, basically got in under the wire. So yeah. Lorenzo, I think, finished up early January and visited his 193rd country, as you might guess. He's an Italian national, but he's been living in Shanghai for over 10 years.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So, do you have on your Counting Countries podcast any kind of guests or recent interviews that you want to talk about a little bit?
I love talking about my guests on that podcast. They're all fantastic. I'll pick out Slawik Muturi. Slawik is half Polish, half Kenyan, and not only has he traveled to every country in the world, he's done it a second time.
Oh, wow.
And he's planning for a third time.
Talk about setting the bar
so
high.
There's an elite club. I've done a little bit of research. I don't know if it's 100% correct. From my calculations, there's 3 people have been to every country in the world twice, and Slavik is one of those.
How old is he, and how long is that all he does, just hop from one country to the other?
I was going to ask that same question. If you're allowed to tell us how old he is.
He's mid-50s, and he's a pretty incredible guy, meaning he was born in Poland to a Pole mother and a Kenyan father. He grew up mostly in Poland but switched between both countries. On top of that, he built the largest real estate management company in Poland and also owns a very large real estate investment portfolio. So this guy's had tremendous success in the business world and has created enough free time to have traveled the world twice.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Any idea when he started? He's in his 50s now. Did he start when he was 4?
Well, technically, because he definitely was visiting Kenya as a kid. Recalling the interview, I mean, he started doing some cool travels during university.
Interesting.
I imagine you've maybe gotten some good advice and good tips from him and other guests.
100%. But the thing is, in many cases, the advice is different. So Slavik loves local transportation, local buses. Obviously, he can afford to do more. But as many people knows, traveling, local transportation is a catalyst to meeting locals. It's pretty logical. Mm-hmm. So there's someone like that. But then you talk to someone like Lorenzo. He's a successful business owner in Shanghai. And his travel has changed over, you know, the last 20 years, meaning 20 years ago, he was backpacking everywhere. He had less financial resources. Now his time is a bit more precious. And, you know, he's flying Emirates business class to get around where he needs to go and to save time. So everybody's really, truly different, and everybody's personalities are unique. And I think you have so many differing opinions on how to do it.
Interesting. So it becomes a melting pot, and you just sort of pick and choose what fits best for you.
But yeah, I think at the end of the day, you got to do what makes you happy and what makes you feel comfortable. It's that simple.
Yep. Yeah.
The common thread is travel, though.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, so... So Rick, you've got three books out there and a couple of films and your podcast. Anything new in the works as far as books or films at the moment?
There's one book. Actually, that's a reminder. So thank you. There's one book I have on my bucket list to do, which maybe I'll use this opportunity to start working on. That would be a book on a Southeast Asian tattoo called Sakyent, and they have this big Sakyent festival at a temple outside of Bangkok, and I went the last 5 years in a row, so I have something like probably like 15,000 photos from attending that event. So I was thinking of making a picture ebook. But beyond that, I'll just be working on my podcast, working on the blog, and creating new content for that.
Nice. It was funny. I was one of the questions until you just mentioned your recent guest. I was going to say, once you get to hitting all of the countries, it has to be a little bit of a letdown for some people, I guess. But others just decide, well, hell, I'm just going to do it again.
Yeah, there's a couple crazy ones who are planning on doing it twice. The other thing I would add on to that is I think once you've finished, at some level, this like takes the pressure off, meaning. Mm. At some level, you want to make sure you complete the list. But once you've done that, then you can go back and do the other things of interest. Like, oh, there's a great festival here that I wasn't able to go to. Or I want to go back to Indonesia because I missed this amazing island and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. In some ways, I think you get flexibility to work on a different type of bucket list.
Because we talked about that last time. That's one of the struggles we always have is – when you go or you're going to go on a trip, do you pick some place you haven't been or go back to one of the many places that you love so much and see it a different way or see different things? So
100%.
A good problem to have, I would say, if you're in the spot like that. Yeah.
And so. There's no wrong answer, because going back to your favorite country is an awesome thing, and getting to explore a new one, same thing. Great to do.
Well, hey, you know, Rick, I find this, you know, fascinating talking with you. I think I could talk with you for 4 or 5 hours if you could handle talking with me that long, which most people can't. You know, the discussions about where you've been and what you've done, what you're doing is incredible. Is there anything that we haven't touched on that you've done recently or going to be doing that you want to chat about a little bit?
I'm going to mention one other guest I interviewed on my podcast, because I think he at some level exemplifies the dedication to some of these people and what they do. So there's a gentleman, his name is Charles Veeley, and he's traveled to every country in the world, plus so much more. And he's also the founder of a website called Most Traveled People. And this website doesn't divide the world into 193 places, but divides the world into 879 places. That's what they define as the world.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And I'll give you one example of the places he visited. It's called Bouvet Island. Bouvet Island is an uninhabited island. No one lives there. And it's literally 3 by 5 miles, something like that, if not smaller. It's located in the South Atlantic, south of South Africa, near Antarctica. And this Bouvet Island is one of the places you need to visit if you want to complete the most traveled person list. Wow. As you might imagine, it's incredibly difficult to visit. You know, there's no airport, there's no people there. But Charles had met someone from the South African Navy in Antarctica. And once a year, South Africa sends a Navy ship to this island to replace a weather balloon or some weather forecasting device. The captain from the South African Navy called up Charles. And he goes, "Charles, we have a ship leaving in 5 days. Can you be in South Africa?" This was right after Thanksgiving. He had just had his first child. And he looked at his wife, and his wife is basically, "Charles, just go. This is your dream." So he takes off. Now, it's 2 or 3 days in open water from South Africa to Bouvet Island. He gets there, and he has about 2 hours on the island while the scientists and the Navy do their requirements. Now, that doesn't sound that bad. 3 days there, 3 days back. But the ship did not return to South Africa for 60 days.
Oh, wow.
Because it was a multi-stop trip over 2 months. So his dedication is at the one percentile. He skipped Christmas. He skipped New Year's Eve. He just had a kid. But his focus, his dream, was completing this list. So you're well-traveled, I'm well-traveled, but there's a whole other level of people out there who are the best-traveled, and I get the pleasure of speaking to one of them every month on the podcast.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. Wow.
So how do they – any idea how they determine the 879 – places? What are the different distinctions for some of those?
Yeah, I mean, there's a committee and there's debates and the list is updated every year. So the reality is I don't know the exact mechanics that are required to be added to the list, but it's very extensive and very in-depth.
So you could be somebody who's completed them all, and then they have a committee meeting, and then they come back to you and they say, "Oops, sorry, you're off the list now. There's 3 more places you need to go to."
It makes it tough.
How many people have completed the list?
Well, that's the question. 0 people have completed the list.
Yeah.
But on your point, there's another group called Travelers Century Club, which was founded, I think, in the 1950s out of LA. Their list is 329 places. A couple years ago, it was 325. When it was 325, there were a handful of people that did complete that list. But as you pointed out, the challenge is, even if it grows by 1 or 2 places each year, these are some of the more difficult places to reach, making, you know, the challenge at some level never ending.
Right, which I guess is intriguing too. For, you know, if you've done it, now you want to.
Yep.
There's another nugget to go after. But wow.
So have you tracked your places against any of those to see how far you are on the 879 or the 329?
I do, but I don't know the numbers offhand. What I would suggest to everybody is there's another group called nomadmania.com. They divide the world into 1,281 places, but they have an excellent interface to keep track of your travels and your map. And on this map, they can track 193. They can track the Traveler Century Club. They can track most traveled people and Nomad Mania and all a bunch of other lists as well. So
They do a World Heritage site.
It's one-stop shopping.
Do you know if they do a World Heritage site list?
They do. So they also have all the UNESCO World Heritage sites listed out, which you can check off by country and keep track of that. And that's another great example. There's 1,000+ UNESCO World Heritage sites, but they are adding, I think, 30, 40, 50, 100 new sites a year, or like about 50 new sites a year. So that's another virtually impossible one to finish.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was just telling the guys. I was looking at that and starting to make my own list because I kind of forgot where I'd been on some of them. And I was like, it's not fair. I go back 5 years ago, I had a higher percentage of sites visit than I do now. And I've been traveling crazy in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
So I think I'll stop adding them.
Wow. Well, this has been great. Like I said, I could, you know, go on for, you know, hours asking questions. So Rick, thanks so much for taking the time to join us during all of this craziness. I guess it makes it a little bit easier since you're stuck in the apartment a lot, but we appreciate you taking the time to join us. I know, you know, for all of our listeners out there, your website is globalgaz.com where you can go to and see or get access to your books, 700 Kilometers to Go, Hit the Road India, Photos from Chernobyl, access to the films you have, Hit the Road Cambodia and Hit the Road India, and access to your podcasts.
Yeah, I'd definitely recommend everybody checking that out, too.
For sure. Cool. And so anything I missed there that you wanted to mention?
No, thanks. I think that will cover everything and keep people busy.
Good. Well, but this time we promise the next time we hit Bangkok, which typically would be January, we'll make sure to check in with you.
I'm going to hold it to you this time. And there will be a serious guilt trip if I do not get a message, guys.
Yeah.
And you'll have to buy the first beer.
That's not a problem.
They'll probably do more than that. Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much. And Jim, I'll turn it over to you if you want to kind of sign us off with our listeners.
Thanks once again, Rick, for joining us today. And thanks to our listeners for joining in to listen to our podcast, Friends of Carry On. You can find us at friendsofcarryon.com and on the social medias at Friends of Carry On. Thank you, and until next time.
And stay safe and healthy out there, everybody.
Be sure to join the Friends next week for another great discussion. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. You can also find the Friends and other content at www.friendsatcarryon.com or check us out on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook by searching Friends at Carry On. Thanks again for joining us, and don't forget to carry on, friends.